Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen, and on today's show, we are going to have part two of our interview with John Little. We did this first interview about a couple weeks ago, and John was a writer for Muscle and Fitness magazine, and he is a big expert on Mike Mentzer and also Bruce Lee. And we had John on the show about a year ago, and Mike's 20th anniversary of his death, of his passing, was on June 10th, I believe, of this year. So we brought John back again to talk more about Mike Mentzer, and John just put together for himself during his time in COVID, he put together two audio tapes of Mike talking, of interviews with Mike. One was done with Peter McGuff, and I think John did the other one. And so he sent that to me, and that was the basis of our interview. So today we're going to continue our discussion with John Little for part two. And then when we get finished with the interview, I am going to read an article. Actually, John mentioned this article during our interview. It's called The Thinking Man's Bodybuilder, Mike Mentzer, written by Jack Neary. And this comes from the October 1979 issue of Muscle Builder magazine. And it's a really, really good article. So you guys are going to want to stick around for that as soon as we get done with our interview with John Little. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right, so we missed last week's show. I was out of town in Chicago visiting my family. My brother had a graduation party for my nephew, Joe Hansen, and he graduated from college. So we had a party together on Saturday, and then Sunday, of course, was Father's Day last week. So I got to spend it with my dad and my family, so that was really fun. And so I didn't get back until later in the week, so we did miss the show last week, but we're back. So I got some emails here. I'm going to read them in a second. But before we get to that, I do want to mention to you guys again about the audiobook version of Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends Volume 1, which was my book that I came out with about 3 years ago. And we now have it in an audiobook version that was narrated by me. So if you guys are interested in purchasing that, you can just go to bodybuildinglegendshow.com, which is the official website of the podcast, and you'll see it right there. You can purchase it online. So anybody who does that, let me know what you think of it, and let me know if you like it. Got some other news. This weekend, I'll be heading out to the Orlando Europa competition, which is like a big trade show. They usually do these in three cities. They start them off in Dallas, which was last month in June. The Orlando one will be this weekend, first weekend in July, July 2nd, 3rd. And I think next month will be Phoenix, Arizona. So Ed Pariso, who is the promoter of the Orlando Europa, he's been doing it for many, many years with his wife, Betty. He contacted me a couple months ago, and they're going to have a section of the expo set up for interviews on a stage. So Bob Ciccarillo will be there. He will be part of the interviews. I think Dennis James was also there last month in Dallas, and I know Dennis will definitely be there in Phoenix because that's where he lives. So Ed wanted to have me out there, and so I was going to try and interview some old school bodybuilders, but that didn't work out. I tried to get a hold of Vince Taylor and Mike Ashley, but they either were busy or they couldn't make it. So Ed is going to have me interviewing Lee Labrada and his son Hunter on Friday night, which I'm really excited about. So I'll get to interview both Lee and Hunter on stage, and we're going to talk, of course, about some old school bodybuilding and about what Hunter is doing to prepare for, I believe he's going in the Chicago pro show and planning on winning that and then going back to the Olympia again, which will be a second time at the Olympia. So I'm really excited about that. So that'll be this weekend in Orlando. So anybody in Florida, if you want to make it out there, I will be on stage interviewing those guys. And I think I'll also be there on Saturday interviewing some new pros. So I'm excited about that. The Ron Love interview we did a couple weeks ago is now up on YouTube. So you can check that out on my YouTube channel under my name. And one of the great things about going to Chicago, besides getting to see my family, was I grabbed some old muscle builders that I had at my parents' house. I had to go searching for them in the crawl space, and they were way in the back, but I got some really great issues from which I think was kind of the golden age of muscle builder from 1976 through 1979. Of course, in 1980, Joe Weider started Muscle and Fitness. He changed Muscle Builder to Muscle and Fitness, and it sort of softened the magazine up a little bit. I think he was trying to appeal to more of a just a general audience instead of just hardcore bodybuilders. But I'll tell you, those magazines from 76 through 79, when you had Jack Neary and you had Rick Wayne writing most of the articles and a lot of stuff about Mike Mentzer and Frank Zane and Robbie Robinson, man, those are some great, great articles. So that's great news for you guys, because if you enjoy me reading these articles at the end of our podcast every week, I'll be reading a lot more of them, and I got some really good ones coming up. What else is going on? Oh, Florida Alternative Medicine, who is our sponsor here at the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, just hired two great athletes as part of their team. Andre Ferguson, who is one of the top men's physique pros, he is now part of the Florida Alternative Medicine team, and also Sergio Oliva Jr. So this is actually the second time I've worked with Sergio, because Sergio used to work for Old School Labs, which I have been working for many years. And so now Sergio Oliva Jr. is part of Florida Alternative Medicine. So congratulations to both of those guys, and congratulations to Florida Alternative Medicine. We had some bad news last week. I don't know if you guys heard this. Melissa Coates passed away. She was a top female bodybuilder back in the 90s. Very pretty girl. I had a friend of mine actually that dated her for a while. And I believe she was only 50 years old, and she passed away, which was really unexpected. And it was all over the internet. A lot of people were really upset about it because she was a great girl. So rest in peace, Melissa Coates. That was really terrible news. We've also had some birthdays this last week that I wasn't here to mention, so I want to mention those. Frank Zane's birthday was on June 28th. So Frank is now, I believe, 79 years old. Next year will be Big Frank's 80th birthday, if you can believe it. So happy birthday to Frank Zane. He is still doing well and still healthy. Also, Joe Nazario, a former Mr. International and a pro bodybuilder back in the 70s and 80s. Joe was also had his birthday on the same day on June 28th. Lance Dreher, Mr. Universe, and NABBA Mr. Universe and IFBB Mr. Universe in 1981. I grew up watching Lance compete in the Chicago area. He was an amazing bodybuilder, incredible arms. Lance had his birthday on June 27th. Happy birthday to Lance. The great Tom Platz, the legendary Tom Platz, had his birthday on June 26th. The beautiful Rachel McLish had her birthday on June 21st. So happy birthday to all those great legends of the sport. And I want to mention my producer, Paul, who was the producer here at the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. He also had his birthday today. So happy birthday, Paul. Paul keeps the show going. Without Paul, we wouldn't have a podcast. All right. So let's get to some of these emails. If you guys want to email me, just email me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. And I will read your emails on the air if you like. All right, this first one was from John Hartman. John is a regular listener on the show. He said, I meant to write about your show with Ron Love. What an entertaining interview, and his sense of humor is fantastic. Aside from you queuing people up and staying out of their way to tell their stories, the humor and laughter is the best. Thank you for the detailed answer a few weeks back regarding muscle loss as you aged and why you stopped competing. I don't have a lifetime of lifting behind me, but I hope that the doctor-prescribed TRT I'm on will help me hold on to the 25 pounds or so of lean muscle tissue I've gained over the last 12 years of consistent hard training and unfortunate yo-yo dieting. Thanks again for all your time and effort on the podcast. All right. Thank you, John. This email says, Dear Mr. Hansen, I applaud your work and I love your interviews and podcasts. You make old school legends like Danny Padilla and the whole golden age era accessible to the younger generations. I'm 23 years old. I live in Germany and I love old school bodybuilding. I have a request. I recently wanted to know more about Freddie Ortiz, and I was shocked that there are nearly no videos about him and not a single interview. And since he is deceased, there is so much history lost. I don't think Freddie is deceased. I believe he's still alive. I believe he's still living in the New York area where he grew up. But he says, so could you, number one, make sure the same fate doesn't await my favorite bodybuilder of all time, Brian Buchanan. I love this guy's physique, but there's almost nothing on YouTube about the guy. I know he's from England and he went to Australia. Maybe that's why. But I figured if someone has a connection to get a hold of him, it's you. And two, have you ever considered a biography series about deceased or inaccessible bodybuilders like Freddie Ortiz, maybe in collaboration with Jerry Branum? I don't know how many people try to get in touch with you, but if you have the time, I would be thrilled to get a short answer from you. Thanks for all your hard work to keep the legends alive and preserve the history of our sport. Best regards, Rafael Rademacher. All right, Rafael. Well, I will try to get a hold of Freddie. I don't know anybody who knows him, but I'll keep trying. And I would love to interview Brian Buchanan also. He'd be a great interview. So, again, I usually find these guys on social media. That's where I find them. Or if anybody knows about them, they sometimes can send me some information on how I can contact them. And I don't think I've seen either Freddie or Brian on Facebook or any kind of social media. But I'll keep trying. And if we put it out there, maybe somebody will come back to me with some information on them. All right, this one says, Hey, John, I loved your Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends book, and I was wondering if you would consider writing a history of bodybuilding in the golden era from the 60s through the 70s and into the 80s, which most people consider the golden age. Writing about the bodybuilders and the contest and the evolution would be great. I love the podcast, Gareth Hudson from the UK. This one says, Thank you for all you do to keep the history of the sport alive. It's so vitally important, especially to the youth today. So quick to not only discard the past, but claim new ways of doing things that were actually discovered by top weightlifters and bodybuilders 50 to 100 years ago. You're doing it right. All the best, Joe from Oceana, California. All right. Thank you, Joe. Yeah, you're so right about these. Some of these younger guys out there now thinking that they don't know about the history of the sport, which is really a shame. And yeah, they think the new way is the best way when sometimes the old way is the really right way to do things. This one is from Andrew Heffernan. Andrew is one of our sponsors on Patreon. He does that every month. So thank you, Andrew. If anyone's interested in becoming a Patreon sponsor, you can just do that on the Bodybuilding Legends Show website. And Andrew writes, Great stuff, John. Since we're on a Mensur jag here, I wonder if you could weigh in on the heavy-duty system of extremely low volume with high intensity. Mensur, Yates, Labrada, to some extent, and a few other pros swore by this method. Jerry Branum mentioned on your show that he got excellent results from it, although he abandoned it long before because, if memory serves, he missed his longer workouts. My sense is that in the long term, heavy-duty training works very well for a few people, reasonably well for some others, but not well at all for the rest. Since it includes a lot of recovery time, it seems like an excellent approach to use when outside stress is high or when you're coming off a competition or a challenging training block, after which most lifters would probably benefit from a return to a higher volume approach. How say you? Have you ever used it or recommended it? And if so, what's your experience? Thanks. Andrew, I really haven't used the heavy duty training specifically or for a long period of time. I have used some methods of increasing the training intensity, like drop sets or forced reps, of course. I've used that a lot. So sometimes I have pushed it. what I found is as I've gotten older and I'm in my 50s now, when I push it to the limit like that, when I push it to where I'm training to complete failure and maybe even a little bit beyond failure, that's usually when I open myself up for injury. So I still train pretty heavy and I like using the compound movements and I mostly train with barbells and dumbbells. But the system that I use now, which is called the MP6 workout, I'm not trying to sell my book or anything, but I wrote a book called MP6 workout. The reason I developed it was I found that as I've gotten older, it's easier to do this type of training, which is basically progressive overload, where I'm slowly increasing the weight or the reps each week. So I'm putting more stress on the muscle, but I do it in cycles. So I do it in 6-week cycles. So after going progressively heavier over 6 weeks, I'll usually take a break. I'll usually do either a light week or I'll do like a superset week where I'm using a little bit lighter weight, more of a pump. What I find is that I can't keep pushing it to the limit like that, like heavy duty recommends all the time, because that's when I end up getting hurt. So for example, the last time I squatted, I can still squat over 300 pounds, which is pretty good for my age. And considering the fact that I've got compressed disc in my lower back, but if I was to take that weight and have a spotter and do the reps until I absolutely couldn't do any more, like until I failed, I think I would be opening myself up to injury. Like I said, I'd probably end up hurting my lower back. I'd probably end up pulling something. So for me, as I've gotten older, I developed this new system, not to sell it as a course to where I can make money, but just as something that would work well for me, where I could still train heavy. I could still use progressive resistance, but not push myself to the point where I might get hurt. You mentioned Jerry Branham. I think when Jerry was trying it, he did get results from it. But if you remember, he talked to Arnold and Arnold told him, he goes, you're not going to last on it because it's very hard to push yourself to the limit like that every workout. And I think that's one of the problems with heavy duty is that you have to really get psyched up and you've got to be ready to push yourself to absolute failure. And that's hard to do all the time. So I think it's good to use on occasion. I think it's good that people are using more intensity and less volume. I think Mike Mentzer was really a big part of changing the sport of bodybuilding through his teachings. Arthur Jones did it before him and Dorian Yates did it after him. But I think Mike really changed the whole generation of bodybuilders when he came out in the 1970s because everybody was training 6 days a week like Arnold was. And they were just using low intensity with high volume. And I think Mike Mentzer really brought home the fact that if you train harder, you can decrease your volume. And that's something I've always done too. I know that if I train hard and heavy, I'm not going to be doing 20 sets or 30 sets of body part. I'm probably only going to be doing around 12 sets of body part or 10 sets of body part. So that's my experience with it. I never did it exclusively, but I think just as I've gotten older, it would be more dangerous to do that type of training where you're pushing it to the limit like that. All right. And our last email comes from Chris Stewart. And Chris says, hey, John, I always enjoy the show. It's great to hear your guests, and I still get inspired by their stories and enthusiasm for the sport. I've got a few suggestions for future guests, all world champions and from the UK. Johnny Citroni, still training 5 times a week and in great shape, age 76. A real approachable guy whose love for the sport never wavers. He should have definitely beat Arnold at the 68 NABBA Pro Universe. Roy Duvall, one of the UK's greatest stars. I'm pretty sure he trained under Vince Gironda before winning the IFBB World Championship. Frank Richards, probably best known for one of the sport's greatest comebacks. It's hard to get a true reflection how big Frank was. Photographs don't do him justice. Charles Clermont, a very much underrated champion with a flawless physique. I was at all the NABBA Universe shows when he competed against Mike Antorino. In the front double bicep shot, Charles' biceps eclipsed Mike's head. That's what it looked like. I hope my suggestions help you. Looking forward to your future show. Regards, Chris Stewart. Yeah, I've already interviewed Roy. We did that a couple years ago. That interview is on my bodybuildinglegendshow.com website. If you look under, I think it's under either a video. It might have been a video interview with Roy. If not, it was under the podcast. And I also interviewed John Citroni a couple years ago, too. That was a podcast interview. I was actually supposed to interview John last week, but our schedules just didn't work out. Of course, he's in England, so it's a 5-hour time difference from where I'm at. But yeah, I'd like to interview John again. I just saw some recent pictures of him on Facebook, and He looks amazing for in his mid-70s. He's incredible. Frank Richards, I would love to interview. And Charles Claremont, I have reached out to him several times, but he did not respond. So I'll keep trying Charles and Frank Richards again. It's another guy I don't know how to get a hold of. But, yeah, he would be a great interview because he was around during the 70s when Arnold was competing. And then he made a great comeback. Like you said, he had that construction accident. And he came back from that and competed in the 80s very successfully. He took fifth at the Night of the Champions. And I think he was in the top 10 at the Olympia that year in 85 as well. So I will try those guys. So thank you for the suggestions. If anybody else has any comments on the show or any suggestions, just send them to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right. So that is all I got for opening, guys. Here is our interview with Mr. John Little, part two of our interview with John, where we talk again about Mike Mentzer and the impact he made on the sport of bodybuilding. Here we go. And I can attest to the fact that Mike really did change bodybuilding at that time, because that's the time when I got involved with bodybuilding was 77.
Right.
And I remember I started off training 6 days a week, training each body part. I think I was training twice a day or twice a week with each body part, but I was doing 20 sets of body part. I was doing exactly what they said in the magazines, and everybody was. Everybody, because when I joined the gym, I remember everybody was training like that. Everybody was training 6 days a week. So then when Mentzer came along, then everybody started questioning it. And I don't think a lot of people went to the Mike Mentzer routine where you're only doing five sets of all-out intensity, but I think everybody cut back. Everybody cut back to 4 days a week. Or even like 3 days on, 1 day off.
Yeah,
I remember I was training with a guy at the time. We were doing 6 days a week and we were training really hard. This guy was like really showing me how to train hard. He was older than me. And I think he was trying to like get me to quit or something. He was trying to crush me, you know. And I was hanging in there and we were going at it. And I remember we had a debate. Like, should we take a day off after 3 days of training? Like, we were really worried that our gains were going to go down.
Just disappear.
Day off, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
I remember when we took that extra day off, my arms grew like half an inch in a month. You know?
Yeah.
So I think around the country, around the world, everybody was changing. They were rethinking this. Hey, this doesn't make sense going 6 days a week. Mentzer's making sense what he's talking about.
Yeah.
And I think he really did have a huge impact on the sport.
Well, and I think, I mean, his critics have basically said, well, you know, in his later years, you know, he was crazy and he was advocating you only work out with two sets every 2 weeks. He never said that. You know, he basically tailored it to the recovery ability of the client he was working with.
Yeah.
And what he found and what he said on the tape was that recovery ability, like a lot of other genetic traits, is expressed across a broad continuum for human beings.
Yeah.
You know, some people can take intense sunlight for only a little bit. Others can take it for hours and hours.
Yeah.
And similarly with training, people can take an intense training stress, maybe only very infrequently. And there's others that can tolerate it a lot more.
Yeah.
But where he was adamant was that you need to train with a meaningful intensity. You know, you can't just curl a pencil and expect to get results. Yeah. You know, that there has to be some effort. And there has to be an endpoint to the effort so that you know you've emptied what you had in the tank.
Right.
Now, if you want to do three warm-up sets or four warm-up sets and then do your set, knock yourself out.
Yeah.
You know, if you only need one warm-up set and can hit it, that's good for you too. Go ahead.
Right.
But once you've done it, you've only completed part one of a three-phase process. You know, that's stimulate. You've stimulated your muscles. Okay, well, now you got to recover from that. That may only be a couple of days. It might be 2 days, 3 days. We don't know. It might be 24 hours for a guy like you.
Yeah.
But recovery has to occur. But you didn't train just to stimulate and recover, stimulate and recover, stimulate and recover, because that there'd be no progress.
Right.
You want to stimulate, recover, grow, adapt. And adaptation takes time as well as recovery. So you stimulate phase one, recover phase two, adapt phase three. And at that point, that's the soonest you can train again if you want to make progress.
Okay.
But you know, if you train immediately, you don't really get to enjoy any of the benefits of the adaptation because as soon as they arrive, you tear it down again.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great way to put it. And Arnold, I think, was able to recover very quickly because I heard stories about him, you know, when
he had to be.
He would train 6 days a week, twice a day for a contest. I mean, I think when he was getting ready for that 75 Olympia, when he got back doing pump or stay hungry.
Yeah.
He came back from stay hungry. He was only 210 pounds. And then he had to get ready for the Olympia in 3 months. So immediately he went into 6 days a week, twice a day training. And I remember like they were always saying he would burn partners out all the time because people couldn't keep up with it. So his
there had to be a huge genetic component, obviously, to hurt him.
Yeah.
The reason that he still, you know, is what he is in the bodybuilding world speaks to the singularity of his, you know, his whole physique and his genetics, and clearly his recovery ability was part of that.
Yeah.
But having said that, there was an interesting thing. Again, it's the way Mike thought about it. Like you and I might look at Arnold and say, well, that's a way to do it. I mean, he did it, right? There's the proof of it. So if you really want to, you know, come back and regain muscle that you lost, like you did from stay hungry to the 75 Olympia.
Yeah.
4 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Right.
But I remember Mike pointing that out and saying, do the math on that. He said, it's 4 hours a day, 6 days a week. So it's that 24 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
24 hours a week times 4 months. So 24 times four times four. And it's like some obscene amount of hours that he was in the gym. Like more, if you work for a living, it wouldn't be possible.
Right.
And then he said, now contrast that with Casey. He said at the Colorado experiment.
Right.
And he said, it's like Arnold. Casey was regaining muscle that he lost.
Mm-hmm.
He said, so they were both underweight when they started.
Right.
Both probably were not unfamiliar with steroid use.
Right.
Safe to say. He said, so, and both were genetic phenoms for building muscle.
Right.
He laid that out. So you got these two guys. You have Arnold, who comes in. He said he was told by John Bailick that Arnold went from 200 to 215 in 75. So he gained 15 pounds in 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And Mike said, how come you, he asked Arnold, said, I asked Arnold, why didn't you come in at 240 like you did in 72 or whatever it was? 74. And Arnold said, I didn't have the time. I just didn't have the time. And then Mike said, but by contrast, he said, Casey gained 60 pounds in 28 days of muscle.
Hmm.
And again, Casey's body fat levels were measured with a radioisotope assay test at the time. And they found that he was at about 3% at the end body fat, which is competitive level.
Yeah.
Like Arnold probably would have been 3% at the 75 Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, you have Arnold who was unsuccessful and gaining back all of the muscle he lost versus Casey, who was successful and gained back way more of it.
Yeah.
He said, so what's the variable? He goes, why was he able to do it and regain all of his muscle and Arnold wasn't? And from Mike's eyes, he said it was the frequency of the training. So Casey trained for half an hour, 3 days a week. Arnold trained 4 hours a day, 6 days a week. He said, even if he stimulated the growth, he wasn't giving his body time to produce it. Just like you said, when you cut back a day, even one day, your arms grew about a half inch.
Right.
You know, same sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I like the fact that he could look at those two things and then bring them together and say, lay it out on the table and say, look at the difference.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, whenever Mike said that at a seminar and I happened to record it this was in 81 on a cassette player. And it was one of those things, that seminar, it was like, wow, this is like an education in bodybuilding, which is what it was if you went to one of Mike's seminars. And I played that tape and I played that tape for years until basically that was almost an auto response from me. So I could quote it verbatim.
Mm-hmm.
And so fast forwarding to after Mike passed away and John Bailick asked me to continue his column in Iron Man magazine, I had a wealth of material to draw from.
Yeah.
And it was all authentic. It was all Mike's stuff. So, but the interesting thing was the bodybuilding industry has always, since Arnold's arrival, kissed up to him Not that it's a bad thing. He's done a lot for the sport. He sells a lot of product. I get it. But whenever I would make that simple comparison that Mike did, I'd quote him from the Colorado experiment. Mm-hmm. John or one of his editors would feel obliged to add an editorial comment. Always. Never fail. Well, I can't. It's not really a good comparison because Arnold was dieting for a contest and Casey wasn't. And I thought, well, you make my point for me.
Yeah.
Because they both went at 3%. Yeah. They ended up at 3% body fat, both of them. This guy, you know, trained a fraction of the time.
Right.
And didn't even have to watch his diet that closely to get the 3%. Arnold was on tuna fish and water and training 4 hours a day, 6 days a week to get to 3%. And he didn't even gain back all the muscle.
Yeah.
And he didn't. And again, in the 80, he was lighter still, you know, so.
Yeah.
It's, you know, Arnold's, you know, give him his due. I don't begrudge his, and by any means, his success, which is well earned in bodybuilding. He was a phenom.
Yeah.
But it's the ones that are in the orbit around him that keep, you know, kissing his ass, basically.
Right, right.
You know, oh, Arnold, oh, you're the funniest guy ever. And oh, didn't he say he's brilliant? You know, he's, well, no, he's not. He's, you know, he's just a guy. He's a guy that had great genetics, was right. No stranger to the needle, worked hard in the gym, built an amazing physique at a time when there weren't very similar physiques to his out there.
Right.
And blew people's minds.
Yeah.
And then parlayed that into a film career and parlayed that into a political career.
Yeah.
He was an ambitious guy who's done very well for himself.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean he was omniscient. And
yeah.
That, you know, and the training. The way Reg Park trained, because Reg Park trained that way, is the best way you ought to train.
Yeah.
Is nonsensical to me. It's just ritualism.
Yeah.
But and that's again, my beef, Chief.
To give Arnold his credit too. I mean, when he was developing his physique, he was building his physique in those peak years, he went way beyond, even though he didn't have the competition, he still pushed himself to be way beyond what anybody else had ever done before.
Again, you look at the pictures of him in 72.
Yeah.
Even in 74.
Yeah.
I mean.
74, yeah. 73.
That may be the greatest physique bodybuilding has ever seen.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it was just staggering.
I know.
You know, less so in 75 and less so again in 80, but.
Right, right.
Man, 72 to 74.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that to this day we've seen a physique like that.
Yeah. Sometimes I look at pictures of him and I said, that's the ultimate Mr. Olympia. You know, that's what.
Yeah. Well, to this day, when you think Mr. Olympia, who do you think of?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the younger guys today, but I think of Arnold, yeah.
Yeah, even though Lee Haney had more Mr. Olympia titles.
Right, right.
It's still Arnold for me. I mean, in terms of when I think of Mr. Olympia.
Yeah.
If I were purely objective and went by who won the Olympia title the most, Lee Haney would be the guy, I think.
Yeah, Lee Haney and Ronnie, yeah.
Yeah.
I think today's generation looks at Ronnie as the best ever. But, you know, I think when you're looking at overall Mr. Olympia, I just think Arnold had more symmetry. His posing ability was greater. His mental attitude of dominating the competition, all that stuff. I think was superior, you know.
Oh, and again, I'm not an Arnold fan, but, you know, I give him his due. You can't deny his impact on bodybuilding at all. And Mike said that too. You know, Arnold, if he was had a gun to his head and say who's the best bodybuilder of all time, he'd probably Arnold. You know?
Yeah, Arnold and Sergio.
Yeah.
But you said no stranger to the needle too. You have to take that into account too of Arnold's, you know, success with his type of training.
Yeah.
And I remember like when being a young kid, going back to when I was a young kid, the thing that we didn't understand, me living in Illinois or someone in Iowa or wherever, you're reading the muscle magazines, you're thinking you got to go 6 days a week, 20 sets, 25 sets of body part. You're not taking into account these guys are all taking steroids.
Right.
The steroids weren't a talked about subject back then.
It was not at all. No.
And, you know, they didn't. And if they did talk about them, they usually downplayed their use.
Yeah, so, a little bit of polish. A little bit of polish.
5%.
Yeah, never mind the 40 pounds of muscle you gave over the past 2 months. Just a little bit of polish there.
Right, right.
Buff that up a bit. Yeah.
So when Mike came in with his philosophy and people started cutting back on the sets and getting more rest days, it worked so much for everybody because most people weren't taking steroids, you know, if you're not a competitive body.
Exactly. Yeah, we didn't know about it. we didn't know about it, you know. And Mike was honest. He was the first guy whose articles I read where he mentioned steroid use.
He was, yeah. He was totally. Yeah.
And he said, yeah, we all do. And those who say they don't take any take the most, you know.
That was, I remember he wrote an article where he said his arm was like 18 and three quarters. And I'm like, that can't be right. He's got to have a 22-inch arm, 21 inch arm like everybody else. But he was so honest about everything. He goes, no, I recorded it. He goes, it's only 18 and three quarters. I'm like, wow.
Yeah, that's right. He said, you know, I didn't do it with a pump or have an oblique angle to the measurement. So I got an extra inch out of it. He was honest. He was very honest. And that's what made him an interesting fellow. He never lied about anything that I can recall.
And that's so refreshing in the world of bodybuilding. You know?
Oh, yeah. And he was very honest about his views on contests, about judging contests.
Yeah.
And even, you know, again, I remember asking when we talked about the best bodybuilders, the way I phrased the question was, you know, who in your opinion, present company excluded, would be the, you know, top five bodybuilders of all time? And he said, well, he said, present company included. He said, I don't see myself as being in the top five physiques of all time.
Hmm.
It was like, whoa, that's quite a concession.
Yeah.
And then he, you know, again, promptly listed the ones that he thought were there. And it was like, wow, that's very candid.
Yeah.
Because you ask any bodybuilder, especially one that is good enough to compete at the Olympia level,
mm-hmm.
and you say, you know, who are the top bodybuilders? Somehow their name is going to find its way in there. Somehow.
Right.
Yeah. So Mike was refreshing that way for sure.
Absolutely. Let's talk about his pro career, John. His whole career was kind of short, but he did his first pro show right after he won that 78 Universe.
Right.
So that was the, I think it was called the Southern Florida Cup or something.
Yeah, Professional Pro Southern Cup, I think.
Yeah. Yep. And it was in, I believe, Miami, right? And this is when the Grand Prix circuits were really starting to go. Because if you look up at bodybuilding, the pro contest, aside from the Mr. Olympia, really started in 1978 when they had the Night of the Champions. And then they had, I think they had the Pro World Cup in July that year. I think they only had those two shows plus the Mr. Olympia. So by 79, Wayne D'Amelio was working with the IFBB and they were expanding it. So they had the first one was in Florida. And Mike was in fantastic condition. This was his pro debut, and he wins and he beats Robbie in that contest.
Yeah, and he was in great shape. And, you know, it's unfortunate that, again, no video.
I know.
God. We have no record of it. You know, I mean, there was a couple of photos. Actually, the only magazine that published any photos from that contest was Muscle Mag.
Yeah.
Bob Kennedy's publication.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some photos from the show, and Mike looked huge. Like, he looked every bit as big as that photo you referenced at the Mr. North America contest.
Yeah, yeah.
He was just big. He was ripped. He was, you know, he looked incredible. But according to Mike, the next show, which was in Pittsburgh, he was even bigger, he said.
Yeah.
He said he felt heavily muscled, more heavily muscled than even at any other point in his career, including 1980.
Right, right.
And as you know, there was kind of a funny story there because he was like ripped. He was huge. You know, Robbie looked worried. Mike got another perfect score.
Yeah.
This is in the pre-judging. And then off Mike goes to have a plate of pancakes and syrup and some orange juice.
Right.
Came back looking like the Michelin man, you know, and he, like you said, he said, you know, just by everything, I could tell there was a big difference in my physique when I came back for the evening show.
Yeah.
Lesson learned. But and he ended up losing the Pittsburgh one to Robbie.
Right, right.
And then New York followed. That was his third pro show, Night of Champions. And he, unfortunately, his mother was dying. He got news that his mom was dying.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to the show more to honor the contractual obligation. So he said, you know, I was not in great shape and, you know, certainly didn't deserve to win and didn't deserve second place. Third place was what he got behind Robbie and Danny. In fact, Danny was the guy who probably should have won that show.
Yeah. I talked to Danny about that when I did his interview. Danny said he scored a perfect score and Robbie beating him at the,
he did. And then Robbie won the show.
Yeah.
But Danny was in tremendous shape.
Yeah.
And Mike had lost his edge and really didn't care really at that point, because his mother died, I think, 6 days after the show or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he had other things on his mind, but nevertheless, he did compete, and he covered those three shows, and then fell into a bit of a depression with the death of his mom.
Mm-hmm.
And then until there was like only 8 weeks or something left to the 79 Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother told him, don't go in. He said, you know, we've been through a lot. You've done three shows, a fourth show in 1 year.
Yeah.
You know, everyone will understand. And for some reason that had the opposite effect on Mike. It spurred him on.
Right.
And he got into what was then his best shape ever.
Yeah.
For the 79 Olympia. And you, young man, happened to go to that, did you not?
Right.
Yeah. Damn. So I never saw Mike compete on stage. So maybe you can share with your viewers what that was like.
Yeah, I remember when the over 200 pound class came out in the prejudging. I mean, he really stood out. You know, you could tell he was going to win the class. And Zane looked great too. And, you know, back then with the two classes, they weren't really compared until the night show, until they actually did the pose down.
Right.
So, unfortunately, you know, for Mike, they weren't compared at the prejudging. And then Mike outscored Zane. I forget what Zane got. He was close to 300. I think he got like 297 or something. But yeah. Mike had 300. And then what they did was they did the pose down, and then the judges did the placement system where they gave a first place to whoever they thought. And I guess Zane just got enough votes to beat Mike.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting. I mean, you know, now that Mike's gone and you look back and think, geez, I wonder what would have happened if he'd won one of those two shows, you know, the 79 or the 80.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I mean, we'll never know, but he came pretty close in 79.
First one too.
Yeah.
And he said he wanted to be the first guy to win his first Olympia, which never happened, except for
Scott,
of course. But
yeah, first time competing in it to win it. Yeah, that was his goal.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it must have – I know we got a lot of mixed messages after the show, because it kind of broadsided him that he'd lost to Frank Zane. Because he thought, in terms of symmetry and proportions, you know, Frank's got – great symmetry and proportions, but so do I.
Yeah.
But I've also got about 25 pounds of mass on this guy.
Yeah.
And, you know, bodybuilding is about bodybuilding. So, you know, I'm bigger, I'm more ripped, I'm stronger.
Yeah.
I haven't lost any symmetry. I've lost, you know, every muscle group was balanced. And so after the show, he spoke to Reg Park, and Reg said, oh, you're too big. When you do that pose, you know, the one you were talking about where he puts his arms out,
because
you take up the whole stage and the audience isn't ready for that. That was Reg Park's thing to him.
Makes no sense.
No. And that's what Mike said to Reg. He said, well, aren't you the guy that, you know, that was your métier was this big mass ahead of your time, and you're telling me that now it's a liability?
Right.
So he just didn't understand it. Then the other one said, oh, you posed too quickly. Only during the pose down.
Right. Right.
And that's when the scores are tabulated.
Yeah.
So really that shouldn't have had any impact. But anyway, he lost the contest and then figured, well, maybe it's because bodybuilding in the late 70s and 80s was starting to break into the mainstream. It was starting to become popular. You know, gyms were opening up as kind of social centers and new magazines were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
You would see it in the movies, more muscular physiques. It was starting to
break through.
Yeah. And so I think part of the thought was, you know, if we put big, big muscle guys, Sergio Oliva, Arnold even types, front and center on our magazines and in our contests, then people aren't going to relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
Frank Zane, you know, he's got mass and he's got lines and he's got good proportion and good symmetry and good shape, pleasing shape.
Mm-hmm.
That's a mainstream physique.
Yeah.
And so I think Mike picked up on that vibe. So he thought, well, the only thing maybe that they're looking at there is definition. That's the biggie.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have to be ultra defined, that's what I'm going to do for the 80 Olympic, because that's apparently what the judges are looking. This is assuming everything is on the up and up. the judges are looking for the best physique.
Yeah.
All the other backroom drama of the 80 Olympia wasn't known at this point. It was just, this is a contest.
Hey, John, before we get into 80, let me ask you about 79, because I've heard people say that Mike blew that contest because he was leading going into the night show. He's leading from the prejudging. And then, like he said he did in Pittsburgh, he went out and ate something, and that's why his stomach was sticking out. Do you think that was true?
No. I mean, you heard on the tapes that when he went into 79, he had pored over all his journals. He had learned his lesson.
Mistake from Pittsburgh, yeah.
He wasn't going to repeat it because it cost him in Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
So, no, he didn't lose it. The comment about his stomach is, I think, explained two ways. One, the photos that you see where Zane's got the trophy and Mike's like this,
yeah,
was the moment the decision was announced.
Yeah.
So you're in like this tight, and the winner is the other guy.
Right.
There's the photo.
I think Zane did a little bit better in the pose down, but that's just because of his experience. You know, I mean, the guy's been competing for 20 years.
Yeah, and Zane was a great poser. But I mean, again, if you put a check mark in every box, mass, definition, symmetry, shape, proportion, posing, okay, you give Zane posing. You don't give him mass.
Yeah.
So that's a wash. So now you're looking at the other categories to determine your winner.
And in Zane's defense, I mean, that probably was his best condition ever of his whole life.
And no argument for me on Frank Zane.
Yeah.
I, again, it depends on what your criteria is.
Yeah.
For me, coming, as we talked about earlier, from the Bruce Lee background,
mm-hmm.
I like the smaller physique in terms of the size. Frank Zane was the guy. I thought he looked awesome.
Yeah.
And that when he did that ad for the Power X, coolest ad I've ever seen in my life. You know, I wanted to look like Frank Zane.
Right.
But if you're looking at it as judging in the categories that we discussed,
mm-hmm.
mass has to be part of it in a bodybuilding show. Has to be.
Yeah.
And so if a guy, as Mike said himself, Zane's really his physique hadn't changed in terms of muscle mass since 68.
Yeah.
You know, he refined it, but he hadn't gained any muscle to that you would notice.
Or not much.
Yeah. So building, very little of that had occurred. You know, body defining, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But if mass is part of the equation, you got to mark Mike up for that because he had it, had it in spades. And he didn't sacrifice proportion or symmetry.
Right.
To get it. And his definition was, if you look at the photos, the photos that I've seen, his definition looked to be the equal of Zane's.
Yeah.
You might disagree with that. You were there, so you might know better. But judging from the photographs I've seen, Zane probably in posing would have won that category, I think.
Plus, Zane was Mr. Olympia two times already, so they probably put on the edge there, you know.
Well, and maybe it's one of those things like in boxing, too, where you got to knock out the champ.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
You're not going to decision.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, I totally accept that, too. And again, like I say, from an outsider's perspective, what's not to like about Frank Zane?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, what a physique. You know, I mean, very impressive physique.
When I interviewed Frank, he kind of dismissed Mike a little bit. You know, when we talked about that, he goes, yeah, you know, he almost was saying he wasn't even close, you know, like follow the leader, I think he said, you know, or something. But I don't think he really gave Mike the credit he deserved for how good Mike looked in that show.
No, probably not. But I mean, again, every bodybuilder is an individual.
Yeah.
And everyone's ego is at different points.
Yeah.
And,
remember things, our own history, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, Frank had a lot of followers and had a great, great physique. Interesting, though, isn't it, that Frank Zane presently trains more like Mike Train?
Yeah.
I saw a video of him, and he's doing like one set of three or four upper body exercises. Then another day he does the same thing with lower body, predominantly machines. Mind you, Frank's older now, but nevertheless, you know, when you're not competing, when you're looking to be healthy and fit and looking good, he's basically doing a heavy duty program.
Yeah.
You know, which was the thing they used to, you got to go 20 sets 6 days a week.
Yeah.
Okay. But,
Well, yeah, I think that year, in fact, in 79, I think he was training with a powerlifter, and he was training heavier than ever before in order to put on muscle. And yeah. He did cut back on his he did take more rest days, you know.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Frank, clearly Frank and Mike were polar opposites.
Yeah.
Intellectually as well. I mean, Frank was into the writings of people like Gurdjieff and some of the spiritualists. Mike was reason, you know, Aristotle.
Yeah.
Guys like that. They philosophically, they were miles apart.
Frank was interpreting his dreams with Carl Jung.
Carl Jung and Mike had gone through psychiatry.
Yeah.
And he'd studied Jung and he'd studied Freud and R.D. Lang and all these psychologists, because that's what he wanted to be at one point.
He wanted to be a psychiatrist, right?
Yeah. And then he thought a lot of it was nonsense, you know, so he basically packed it in. But and in training too, I mean, Mike liked the Bill Pearl type physique.
Yeah.
So mass. You want to be big.
Right. Right.
I'm not sure who Frank's heroes were, but Frank kind of created his own his own category almost.
Yeah.
There wasn't a physique like Frank Zane until Frank Zane showed it.
Right. Yeah. I think Steve Reeves was a big influence, but.
Yeah.
As far as, you know, the definition and stuff that Frank had, I mean, he created his own, like you said, he created his own life. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, Frank probably, I mean, I don't know, if I've never really heard Frank speak particularly well of any of his competitors.
Yeah.
To be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was a 79. Mike, as he later admitted, said, I put too much emphasis on winning that contest. Like you didn't, it's not in the tapes that you heard, but he did tell me the three times that he came to a near-death experience in preparing for that show. I mean, the calories that he was consuming were almost non-existent, like 500, 600.
Yeah.
And then you'd ride a bike 40 miles on the beach or on the boardwalk on the beach.
Yeah.
Come back, pose in the sun for a while. Then go back down and run 6 miles because you think the judges want definition.
Yeah.
And then you go into the gym and train the way Mike trained 3 days a week.
Yeah.
With negatives and forced reps and everything else.
Rest pause. And
yeah. And as Boyer told you, remember when he was, he looked out his window in Sydney and he saw Mike walking up that, it was like a near the beach. There was a walkway up to the hotel. He said it took, by his estimation, Mike about 40 minutes to get up there.
Jeez.
Because he just was so exhausted. But yeah. Mike told me that he was eating dinner once with Kathy, and next thing you knew, his face was on his plate. He just boom out. And then, you know, another time he couldn't get out of bed. Like just couldn't move his limbs to get out of bed. Couldn't lift his arm without being exhausted.
The 80 Olympia was in October, and I think he said he started preparing for it in February.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he just, and he said everything he did was done with the purpose of how do I improve to win the 80 Olympia? Everything. He said from going to the post office to taking out the garbage, what can I do today to improve?
Wow.
And so that was what he brought to bear on this contest.
Yeah.
Again, assuming it's above board in terms of the judging and everything else.
Yeah, yeah.
So when he went there, he knew what he put himself through to get into the kind of shape that he assumed the judges, at least the ones that he spoke to from the year before, to get the look they were looking for.
Right, right.
And then when Frank Zane had his accident and lost muscle, suddenly a lane had opened up. To get to the Mr. Olympia.
Right.
So when he heard Arnold was going to compete, number one, when he looked at Arnold, he thought, well, I got nothing to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's not the Arnold I remember.
Yeah.
Arnold from 74, it's going to be like me looking at Robbie, you know, before my Mr. Universe show.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this Arnold, no, I don't think he's going to beat me.
Right.
And then we know how the Olympia played out. Mike was given fifth place and Arnold was given first place. And at that point, he just said it opened his eyes. He said it, in retrospect, it was not a bad thing to have lost the 80 Olympics because it opened my eyes as to the reality of the commercial interests within the sport.
Yeah. Yeah.
And once that was evident. He knew he wasn't going to win a contest.
Right.
Like that was over. That he wasn't going to win. So why put yourself through that kind of hellish training and dieting?
Yeah.
When you know that it's no one's looking at your physique anyway. They've already got the contest figured out.
Yeah.
As to who's going to win.
Yeah. During those interviews too, it was interesting hearing Mike talk about the meeting, the famous meeting that the morning of the contest where Arnold tried to psych everybody out. And he made that, that comment to Mike, and the whole meeting was about Arnold wanted to have the two classes, the under 200, over 200, mm-hmm. where Mike and everybody else, all the other 15 competitors wanted one class.
Right.
And they all signed a petition and they showed it to Ben Weider. And then Arnold was the one who didn't want it. So Mike went into detail about that meeting. It was really interesting. He said he said a disparaging comment about Samir Banu.
Yeah.
Which I never heard before. And
yeah, that was the first I'd heard about it too. Yeah. I don't know what the details were because that was from Peter's interview. Okay. So Peter didn't have a follow-up question on that.
Yeah.
But he just said, you know, he knew Samir and he thought, you know, Samir can handle himself. So if he wasn't offended by it, I'm not getting involved.
Right. And then I guess Bill Pearl stood up and he said, okay, well, we've got an issue here. We've got to resolve it. So, you know, I'm not going to speak for you guys. You guys can debate this, but we have to resolve this issue before we get the contest underway. And then Boyer Coe stood up and he said, well, why don't we let Arnold take the floor and, you know, let him speak on why he wants to have two classes. Everybody here wants to have one class. Arnold, let's hear your opinion. And then Arnold's response to that was, Boyer, why are you acting like a baby? Why don't you act like a man?
Yeah, I know. Like what?
And then Mike got pissed off and he goes, wait a minute. He goes, nobody's acting like a baby here except you. And then he goes, Mike Mentzer, everybody knows you lost the Olympia last year because you let your stomach hang out. And then Mike went over towards him with his finger and he said, Arnold was standing up. And then Arnold sat down, which he in the pictures, Arnold sitting down. And I don't know exactly what he said to him, but he said, you know, everybody here is trying to conduct business and you're the one being a baby or whatever. And then Arnold backed down from him and then it was getting really tense. And then Ben Weider stepped in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I always remember that photo when it first came out with Mike pointing his finger at Arnold. Yeah. I was like, wow. You know,
if there was ever a time when somebody should have had a video camera, that
would have been amazing.
Classic.
But, you know, even to me, that buttressed Mike's legacy for me even more when that photo came out.
Yeah.
Because it was the embodiment of sticking it to the organization.
Yeah.
You know, the commercial interests of bodybuilding were personified by Arnold.
Yeah.
Weider, the products. I mean, Ben ran the contest. Joe ran the publicity arm with the magazines for the contest.
Right.
Arnold was their poster boy who had no other job than to sell products for them.
Mm-hmm.
And here they are in this room, and there's Mike Mentzer in his face, basically telling what a load of bullshit the whole thing was.
Yeah,
it was like, wow, that's a poster for me.
I know.
The guy who stood up to the industry. You know? So I always like that. It's the it's funny though. I mentioned about the stomach thing. I mean, whose stomach looked more ripped in 80? And I would even say in 79, when Mike does a vacuum shot, you tell me that's a big gut?
Right, right.
I don't think so. I mean, Frank Zane's the only guy that comes close on the vacuum to Mike. And even then, Mike's waist looks smaller. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was incredible. But the 79 photo that was referred to was, well, and the other thing too is that Mike trained his abs with weights.
Yeah.
So he had thick abs.
Yeah,
and his reasoning for that is he said, what would be more incongruous than a guy that weighs 220 pounds having the abdominal development of a guy who weighs 140 pounds?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said, you know, the muscles should be thick and well-developed and abs are skeletal muscles. They need to be developed too. So he was doing sit-ups with weights. And I mean, he had well-developed abdominal muscles.
Right.
Like you could probably stick your fingers in up to about here. In the cuts in his abs, but naturally when you exhale, it's not going to look like you're inhaling, you know, but that wasn't why he lost the contest. But
yeah, we all know Arnold would say anything just to get under anybody's skin.
Well, it's funny. Mike also said, cause Peter had asked him about, Arnold, you know, being the later claiming that it was all a psych job. And Mike's a little load of crap. He goes, do you honestly think professionals and veterans like Boyer Coe or Chris Dickerson are going to be psyched out because Arnold raised an eyebrow?
Right.
No, nobody was psyched out. They were just pissed off and ready to go on stage, you know?
Yeah.
Get it going. But,
I just read Jack Neary's article about the 80 Olympia in one of my previous podcasts. So it was interesting rereading that because they said that CBS television only interviewed two people backstage, Arnold, because he was Arnold, and Mike Mentzer, because they thought Mike was going to win. And then, they never showed that footage ever, you know.
And it's disappearing. It's funny. I about 10 years ago, I contacted Sherman Egan, who Boyer mentioned when you were interviewing.
Yeah.
And he was the producer there in Sydney for the 80 Olympia.
Right.
And he, I asked him, I said, can I ask you just independently why it wasn't broadcast? I knew what Mike had told me, but, you know, I wanted to hear for myself from the guy that was there. And he said, we didn't broadcast, he said, because of the stink of the thing. That was his quote. He said, it looked fixed and corrupt to us. And so he mentioned that he had some guys and he didn't remember their names, like Boyer and that, to watch it.
Yeah.
And he said that, and it was, he said the winner was being booed. He goes, we could hear it on our tape. He said, so how do you broadcast that?
Right.
You know, here he is, the greatest bodybuilder of all time. Boo. You know, it's like, it didn't make sense.
Right.
And he didn't, and none of the people that were involved in the production thought Arnold was going to be the winner.
Right.
And these are guys that really don't know anything about bodybuilding. Right. And
right.
So even they were looking at it and saying something's really off about this. And the fact that he wasn't doing the mandatory poses and was getting a perfect score. They couldn't make that connection. And so then I asked him, I said, well, is it possible to see the footage? Because I knew Boyer got to see it many years ago. Yeah. I mean, why not me?
Right.
And he said, well, he said, let me call you back. He said, I'll check with our archives. And he called me back and said, it's gone. He said, I have no idea what happened to it.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
They don't even have it. Yeah.
So I don't know what happened to it. I do know Arnold has since purchased the rights to the comeback.
Oh,
and that's mothballed now. So you're not going to see that except maybe on YouTube.
Right.
So the only footage, such as it is Wayne Galoshes. Of the 80 Olympian. It's too bad. If you look at
Norm Comich, did you ever see that footage, John? Norm Comich, are you aware of him?
Is he the guy from Australia who?
He was a fan who lived in New York, and he was in Australia then. I guess.
Yes.
He had his camera with him, and
I think Wayne Galosh worked out a deal with him.
Yeah, he did. He put like. I think
that's where I saw it. It's on a two DVD set.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's cool. I mean, it's a different angle, but man, you need Dramamine to watch it. You know, it's just like all over the place. So,
right.
It's too bad. It would have been nice to see really good quality footage.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
But anyway, that was the end for Mike. That was,
yeah.
Well, truthfully, he decided he wasn't going to compete the next year. But then when the 81 Olympia went down and it was another, you know, dragon's or viper's nest of corruption, he just decided the whole industry is it's over. So that was the end for that.
Well, I don't want to keep it too long, John, but if we could talk just a little bit about what happened with Mike, where he went through that bad period, because he said in the interview that when he was training for the 80 Olympia, he started doing amphetamines, and that's why he was doing such an incredible work output, you know, where he was doing all this cardio and eating these low calories and, you know, training so intensely. And he said he would get up at like 4 o'clock in the morning and read philosophy for 3 hours. And then, you know, he had so much energy and he was so productive because of the amphetamines. And he wasn't doing the amphetamines, like he said in the interview, to get high.
He
was never into that. He was just using it as a performance enhancing drug.
Yeah. He wanted, you know, I mean, I guess if you're on 500 calories a day.
Yeah.
And your goal is to look a certain way, which requires a huge energy output.
Yeah.
Your body is going to basically tell you not to do that at some point.
Right.
Knock it off. Don't do it. And I guess the amphetamines probably gave him the ability to find the energy to do what he needed to do. And as long as it was directed, there wasn't a problem. It wasn't, they were, as I understand it, they were prescription. He wasn't getting them on the street.
Yeah.
And he wasn't, you know, taking them by the handful, but he was taking them. And then after the 80 Olympia, and after being essentially blacklisted in bodybuilding,
mm-hmm.
He went to work for Arthur Jones briefly, about 6 months.
Right.
That didn't work out, but it turned out that he was offered a job as to be the editor of his own magazine. It was called Workout Magazine.
Right.
And he loved it. But he was also, you know, same sort of tunnel vision with the magazine that he was for the 80 Olympia.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be the best. It had to be better than the competition. And that meant he was going to write more articles. He was going to be involved in the photo shoots. He was going to be involved in the layout design. He was going to be talking to the distributors, all of that stuff. So amphetamines again,
yeah,
you know, to just keep him focused. And then suddenly you're up 2 or 3 days in a row and you're not aware of it. Working, yeah. working. And then he got a phone call when they were about into their 11th issue or so, that the money guy for Workout Magazine said, you know what, man, put my money on something else. Magazine's done. Click. So now this thing that you've been so invested in, just like he was with bodybuilding in 80.
Yeah.
It's been ripped away from. It's gone. You better find another line of work.
Right.
And on top of that, his dad dies. His hero.
Right.
Like about 2 weeks later or something. And on top of that, he breaks up with the girlfriend that he's been with for 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
So wham, 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 about 3 or 4 emotional shots in a row.
Right.
With amphetamines.
Right.
So what happened was reality changed, his perception of reality. I used to get phone calls from him at that point. And it would be Mike, and then it would be Mike talking. It would be like me saying to you, yeah, geez, have you seen the new Muscle and Fitness that just came up? And we're having a conversation. Yep. Yeah. And I flipped the page and, you know, I was, there were 3 dancing bears and they were staring at me.
Hmm.
And that's how the conversation would go.
Wow.
And it was like, and for me, as someone who knew Mike well, the fact that he'd started the conversation out normally, rationally,
right?
I knew he was there. That Mike Mentzer was there.
Right.
And suddenly this other thing had come in. And to me, it was almost like a puff of smoke had come up to kind of obscure that. And I was trying to reach through it to keep a tether on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that turned it around for him, interestingly enough, was philosophy.
Hmm.
And it was the knowledge that the principle of identity and objectivism, which seems very simplistic, says a thing is what it is. Everything has a nature. Your mind has a nature. Your muscles have a nature. That's how we know how to isolate them when we train them.
Okay.
And figuring out how the mind functions in terms of what it accepts into its consciousness and then is processed through the subconscious,
mm-hmm.
so that it stays within you.
Right.
And whatever he had done had shifted that, so that things that were not reality were coming into his consciousness and now being stored in the subconscious, and that became his reality.
Hmm.
But when he read this passage in Ayn Rand, that part of the philosophy, that things are what they are, that the mind has an identity, that you choose what comes into your mind. You can choose to accept the negative and the nonsense or this or that, or you can focus on what was real.
Hmm.
And then taking that and applying it back to what was real before this thing happened was an act of willpower on his part, that the drugs that they gave him during periods of institutionalization couldn't equal. And they would just pacify you. But suddenly, through an act of will and applying his mind, he was able to recognize that a lot of these phantasms that he'd been experiencing weren't real. I mean, he was the last one to come to that conclusion.
Yeah.
But he would be institutionalized and come out and say, well, these, you just don't get it. You know, what I know, this is real. This really happened, blah, blah, blah. And I think part of it was wishful thinking, wanting the world to be different than it was.
Yeah.
Not as much hurt in it for him in terms of death of family members, loss of ideals, bodybuilding.
Yeah.
Loss of productive, creative work like a magazine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly that was painful. The world suddenly was a very, very ugly place.
Yeah.
And to top it off, nobody from the bodybuilding world cared.
Was supportive, right?
No, they just opened another can of bodybuilders. What do we care about him? You know, so that I know that hurt him, but he also, you know, kind of accepted it and said, "Hey, I know everybody's got their life problems, right? They don't have time to worry about me." But it would have been nice if somebody gave a shit. You know,
I think in the interview with Peter, he did mention you, John. He said you were the only one really that reached out to him. And
well, I mean, Mike was a friend. He was a hero figure to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably would have been no different than if your hero had contacted you and you thought, what can I do to help? You know, and it was a human being in need of help, you know, and Mike had meant too much to me to say, oh, I'm not going to take the call. I remember sometimes we'd be on the phone for 4 hours.
Wow.
But I knew that I could reach him.
Yeah.
You know, and then I'd get him on one. Like there was a time where he was convinced that God existed. No, Mike was an atheist and suddenly he, again, you know, the imperfect world, the perfect world, someone who cares, a being that cares. And how does that tie in? Well, you know, the Nautilus symbol is very spiritual. It represents stages in a journey in various religions and Eastern thoughts. And Arthur Jones designed a cam that looks like a Nautilus shell. And if you ever look at the human body, the cochlea of the ear is shaped like a Nautilus. This is the stuff he was saying. And therefore, Arthur Jones was God.
Right.
I was like, what? I said, Mike, come on. Like, listen, you don't believe any of that. You even said to me at one point that you didn't believe in God because that would mean that there is such a thing as a realer reality, which is a contradiction in terms. There is only this reality.
Right.
And it was that kind of thing that I think Mike appreciated later because it was causing him to snap out of it a bit and to rethink that, yeah, okay, there is a real reality. That is reality. And then again, the law of identity and the blah, blah, blah. But when people later said, man, he went on about philosophy and I rambled on it. Well, yeah, it saved his life, literally.
Yeah.
If he hadn't, like for some people that are in prison, it's the Bible or the Quran or something that has given their head a shake and brought them back to leading a better life.
Right.
With Mike, it was philosophy, and specifically Ayn Rand's philosophy. And since he knew that without that philosophy, he would probably be dead, he took it seriously. And so when young bodybuilders would ask him about topics that might seem frivolous, Mike would answer philosophically because he wanted them to inculcate those principles where they wouldn't allow distorting agents into their minds the way he did.
Yeah.
Which led to the problems. So yeah, he did. There were two Mike Mensers that I knew. And the first one was the seeker. So up until 1980, Mike didn't believe, well, he was seeking truth. He read anything he could get his hands on in philosophy, existentialists like Jean-Paul Sartre, Friedrich Nietzsche in particular, trying to find truth. See, that's what he liked about Arthur Jones. Jones was very dogmatic and matter of fact and black and white, and this is right and this is wrong. And the Nautilus machine is a rational barbell and it's better than this. And
right.
That appealed to Mike, you know, but he was a seeker then. He was looking for truth. And then there was the Mike that believed he had found it. And that was the post mental illness period, if you will, where philosophy became his religion in a way, and specifically objectivist philosophy,
mm-hmm.
because it had literally made a life-changing difference to him. and pulled him out of, well, I mean, it pulled him out of suicide, I would say, on occasion.
Yeah.
I mean, Mike Mentzer could have left us many years before he did.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, to me, it's funny. Bill DeSimone, whom I have tremendous respect for in the bodybuilding world, he's a brilliant biomechanist when it comes to exercise,
mm-hmm.
said, you know, Mike Mentzer's story is a cautionary tale. And I don't know. I view it as anytime if you try to emulate someone else's life, that is a cautionary tale. Don't do it because it's not you.
Yeah.
Be who you are. Don't try and ape someone else's persona. But when you look at what he did and how high he went in bodybuilding and how far he fell,
mm-hmm.
only to have a self-made renaissance,
yeah.
to come back and launch personal training, which is now the template for all of us one-on-one personal trainers.
Yeah.
And to have a Mr. Olympia or a future Mr. Olympia fall under his tutelage and win back-to-back Mr. Olympias.
Yeah.
That's quite a comeback story.
Yeah.
And what makes it more impressive is it was by sheer application of his will.
Yeah. Yeah.
To make himself better.
Yeah.
That it accomplished it, you know, and or that it happened. So cautionary, perhaps, but really you're doing him a disservice if that's all you see. This is a very inspiring story on the early level physically, great physique.
Yeah.
But on the latter stage, mentally and intellectually, to be able to, through the power of your own mind and the ideas that you put in your mind, defeat mental illness.
Yeah.
I almost don't want to call it mental illness because it was episodic. It wasn't, you know, like manic depressiveness that had run through a family for generations. But when you were institutionalized up to 3 times, you got a problem.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a problem with the mind. Something's not processing things properly.
Right.
But to recognize that while you're in that dark cycle.
Yeah.
And pull yourself out is phenomenal. It's an amazing achievement. And
I didn't realize I did that, John, until I heard the interviews. I didn't know he
pulled. Yeah, well, he said that in the article that Peter McGuff wrote. I think you find it online, but it's
okay.
As I mentioned before, it's probably the single best article written about Mike. And I've never really, until now, I've never really talked about, you know, the things that Mike and I talked about when he was in that condition, but I think it might serve as helpful maybe for people that are maybe in a similar position that mm-hmm. you can heal yourself to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, barring a chemical imbalance that is genetic or something like that, that a lot of it has to do with, you know, the old thing, garbage in, garbage out. It depends on what you accept in as being true. And what is not, but that there is a means you have to filter that.
Yeah.
So that things don't have to go off the rails.
I think some people in the bodybuilding world believe that he was so upset over the 1980 Olympia that he went crazy and he was walking the street.
Yeah, no.
And
no.
It has nothing to do
with it. Mike was, I mean, he was over that. If you look at the videos, I think I put a couple up on my Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
Just excerpts of him bantering with Boyer Co. when they were at Nautilus.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1983. That was 2 years after the Olympia. He doesn't look like a guy who's stewing too much about it.
Right.
You know, he's having fun. They're working out. They're talking, cracking jokes.
Right.
No, it was a perfect storm of emotional issues that hit all together at once.
Yeah, yeah.
It sent him off the rails. And, I mean, it. There, as they say, but for the grace of God, could be any one of us, right? I mean, who knows how we'd react if, you know, your livelihood was suddenly pulled out from under you, your faith was ripped away from you, and your parents are killed.
Yeah,
it's here. And your girlfriend is out of your life, all back to back to back to back.
Yeah.
And you're taking an exogenous agent, the sole purpose of which is to keep you awake. So that's all you think about.
Right.
You might be looking for something to get your mind off it somehow, you know?
Yeah. So what was Mike's ultimate, what actually killed him? It was a heart attack, right?
Yeah, he. Yeah, I saw somewhere online they said he died from too many painkillers, but that's not the case. I've seen his autopsy report. Yeah, it was just cardiac arrest, but he'd had like 3 silent heart attacks.
Mm.
Last time I saw him, he was in the Veterans Hospital in Santa Monica, and he'd gone in there because he'd had a heart attack. I mean, his health, he had some problems there in the last 2 or 3 years of his life. He'd fallen down the stairs, he'd torn a tricep, he had
he had
neck surgery, so he was in pain from his neck. There was some sort of blood disorder because he was going to give Ray a kidney, his brother. He was going to donate a kidney to him.
Right, right.
And then when they checked the blood, they said, he can't. There's a problem here.
Mm.
And that's when he had a clotting issue. So I know he was on blood thinners because he developed a nosebleed and had to be hospitalized again because it wouldn't stop. And then, that was the time when I saw him in the hospital. I thought, well, you can't train clients like this, obviously.
Yeah.
Phone maybe.
Yeah.
But I thought, what can I do to help? How can I help? And it dawned on me that he hadn't had a book in the bookstores since 1981, 82.
Okay.
But I thought, the bodybuilding world knows about him.
Yeah.
Because he was an Iron Man at that point. But you still had to, it was a pain in the ass. It was mail order.
Yeah.
If you wanted his book, you had to clip the coupon or call him. And send money in and you wait for the thing. I thought, wouldn't it be neat to have as a lightning rod in the mainstream, the bookstores, a book?
Yeah.
And people could go to your website from reading the book and maybe, they book a consult or whatever. So he said, I don't know if I'm up to writing a lot. I said, here's the beauty of it, Mike. You've already written it. I said, because I have every article you've ever written.
Right.
I have every book you've ever written.
Right.
So what we'll do is just go over and say, right now, from your vantage point, what are the valid principles of training?
Right.
Not what you wrote in the 70s, unless you think they're still valid.
Yeah.
And let's just focus on that. So that's what I did. I went through all of his writings, put together, I just basically arranged them in chapters, and I sent them to Mike and said, what do you think? That's out. That's out. That's okay. I'll add this to that, blah, blah, blah. And within, I don't know, I'd say 3 months, it was done. The manuscript was done.
Wow. Okay.
And then starting in April, I reached out to a publisher and tried to get them interested and pitch the book. And they didn't know, hardcore bodybuilding, it's not really their thing. But it went back and forth and back and forth. And finally, they sent an agreement over in April. And I didn't like the agreement. I thought it was too boilerplate.
Yeah.
And Mike was saying, it'd be nice to get the advance, Anyway, it's funny. I pulled this out before we did our thing tonight. This is the final agreement that came through. It was May 8th.
Okay.
2001. So they had the manuscript already at that point. Mike had signed off on it. And they sent this May 8th, 2001. Publisher had signed it in May.
Wow.
And I signed it on June 6th, 2001.
Wow.
And then sent, there was 3 copies. I sent by FedEx overnight to Mike. And he signed it on June 7th, 2001.
Wow.
4 days before he died.
Wow.
And then sent it to the publisher. And then he was dead 4 days later.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So that was tough doing that book because it was the last thing I had with Mike. The publisher would contact me and, what photos are we putting in? And I was like, oh, God, I go through photos and there it is. But that became high-intensity training the Mike Mentzer way.
Okay.
So that was the last thing we worked on. And indeed, that may be the last autograph he gave because it was only, 4 days before he died.
Wow. Crazy. Unbelievable. Did his dad die of a heart attack, John?
I believe that's what it was. Yeah. There was a history of heart trouble in the family.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some respects, we were lucky we had him as long as we did.
Yeah.
I think there was a genetic time bomb in there ready to go off. And
yeah,
he only lived to be 49, unfortunately. So
Yeah.
That's not very old. You know, I'm 60 now, so I look back and like, good Lord.
Yeah.
You know, I was 40 when he died, or almost 40.
Yeah, I remember everybody at the time thought I was really young. We were all shocked when he did pass, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it's interesting, like you say, he has changed bodybuilding.
Yeah.
He did live a very interesting life, and to know him was to learn from him.
Yeah.
He threw off a lot of sparks, you know, and which started a lot of fires for people.
right.
But he was super helpful, very funny guy, a very caring guy. And in many respects, a very forgiving guy. Mm-hmm. For a lot of what he had suffered. But he was, there isn't a day goes by I don't miss, you know, because the things that I know would have meant something to him, I can't share it with him now. Like, I did a documentary on Leonard Peikoff, who is Ayn Rand's right-hand guy.
Mm.
He was a student of hers for 30 years, knew her better than anyone. When she died, he was her legal and intellectual heir.
Yeah.
And Mike had written to Leonard Peikoff before and was a fan, had his books, had some of his courses. And for me to do this film on the guy and spend time with him at his house, I mean, I would have loved to have picked up a phone, Mike, you know, say hello to.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it. So anyway, there's just things like that that make me think about him quite a bit, you know.
His popularity continues, you know, 20 years after his death, he's still.
Yeah.
Like I said, the interview we did together last year was like one of my highest downloaded interviews, I think, because we were talking about Mike Mentzer.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think it would only be downloaded because of Mike Mentzer. You know, it's I don't fool myself. I'm a footnote on that story, but he's a fascinating guy and a guy who did stand up for what he believed in.
Yeah.
And that's always inspiring to people.
Yeah.
And a smart guy who was a fount of interesting ways to look at the world. You know, I always remember interviewing him and him saying, anything I am or am not is a result of the choices I've made or my abdication thereof. And it was like, Jesus. A, who talks like that? And B, that's a profound statement. You know, whereas I remember going to a seminar with that Arnold did, and it was, you got to buy all the books and courses of everybody and see what works for you.
Right.
Well, that was worth the $50. Thanks, pal. But it was, you know, Mike Mentzer seminar was unlike any other seminar. I mean, it was like going to university.
Yeah.
You would sit down and he would go to the chalkboard and he would go through nutritional science.
Yeah.
Not, you know, not faddist beliefs or protein or supplement sales.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go through physiology and the requirements of productive exercise and including genetics and realistic expectations. And it was a great learning experience, you know, and there's nobody that's come forward since then that can take his place, you know, that has done it.
Yeah.
Most of it is still back to our night big, you know.
I wonder what he would have thought about bodybuilding today.
Hard to say. I mean, he was at heart a fan. So Mike would have been up on who was the Mr. Olympia was and all that.
Yeah.
And he liked mass, so he probably wouldn't be too taken aback by it.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
But he would probably still be trying his damnedest to get him to cut back their volume and frequency.
Right. So, right.
Yeah. But it's interesting because, you know, he did he talked about people that were not great responders on that continuum, you know, and that for those people, sometimes two or three sets once every 10 days was optimal.
Yeah.
And it's funny, again, at my facility, I train regular folk, not a Mr. Olympia candidate to be seen.
Right.
But when we tested people's composition and when they responded from a workout, like when the results showed up, it was usually 7 days on average. Mm-hmm. And we found, hate to say it, but we found two sets once a week produced more in terms of lean mass than three sets once a week, four sets once a week, or six sets once a week, which, you know, make of it what you will, but for regular people, who are, you know, older, not in their peak years, 17 to 20.
Right. Right.
Recovery ability isn't what it was when they were at that age.
Yeah.
So you have to treat that as a component of the workout, the rest interval, yeah, every bit as much as the workout itself.
Yeah.
In terms of support. And interestingly enough, that's what Mike Mentzer was advocating way back 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And was he crazy or was he ahead of the curve?
Well, he must have had something because he, to be remembered all these years, you know, obviously he made a huge impact in the sport of bodybuilding for sure.
Oh, yeah. No, he was a good man and be sorely missed.
Yeah, still is. Absolutely. But still is, right.
Thank you to you and your podcast. We can still remember him from time to time.
Absolutely. And thank you, John, for coming on the show and talking at length about Mike. And before I let you go, talk about the project you got coming up later this year, because I think it's really interesting. The book.
The book I'm working on has nothing to do with bodybuilding.
Right.
Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah, yeah. I just thought
it was. But it's, it's a true crime story. It's coming out in two volumes because it's lengthy.
Yeah.
But it's a fascinating story about an Irish family that immigrated to Canada in the 1800s.
Okay.
And they were kind of like family of Mike Mentzer's in a way, in that they were autonomous. They didn't bend a knee to anybody. And what happened over time was they were very loyal to their family. They were called the Donnellys.
Okay.
And I believe there was seven sons and one daughter.
Okay.
And the sons all grew into big, strong, muscular, good-looking guys who didn't take any crap from anybody.
Okay.
So as long as they had that nucleus or that family, people cut them a wide berth. And they were tough. I mean, they were tough as nails, these guys.
Yeah.
Fight at the drop of a hat. And one of them fought a constable in the town for 30 minutes nonstop.
Wow.
And a crowd of 100 people gathered around. And when someone went to break it up, another constable showed up with a revolver and said, "No, it's a fair fight. Let him go." 30 minutes. But that's the way they were. But because they were loyal to their family, it was very factional at that time in Canada and probably the United States as well with the Irish immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Catholics that stayed amongst themselves, the Protestants that stayed amongst themselves. You didn't interact. You know, you went to your respective churches. You went to Catholic or Protestant businesses in the nearest towns. And the Donnelly said, "Screw that. You know, this is a new country. This isn't Ireland. We'll go where we want.
Uh-huh.
If I want to spend money in a Protestant store, I'll spend it in a Protestant store. And if I want to spend it, you know, at the Catholic store, I'll spend it at the Catholic store. And no one's going to tell us how to spend our money or what to do." Well, over a period of time, a faction developed that was anti-Donnelly.
Okay.
They were too terrified to do anything when all the brothers were around, but enough time passed that one brother was killed in a knife fight. Another one died in pneumonia. Three had moved away and started families. Suddenly the group that was behind now got brave. And one night at about 1 a.m, they snuck into this house where the parents and the son and a cousin from Ireland were staying and beat them to death and then set fire to the house, burned it down. And then went up the road where another brother was staying with another brother, called him to the door and shot him, killed him. And so that there was only three brothers left out of seven and a daughter. And unbeknownst to the mob that did this, there was about 30 or 40 of them. There was a 14-year-old boy that had been staying overnight with the Donnellys who hid under the bed and saw everything.
Oh, wow.
So they had an eyewitness to the murders. But they had two trials, and both trials they acquitted the killers because it was the township jury. Mm-hmm. And they knew that if one guy hung, 20 guys would hang, and that would be 20 families impacted, which would be 20 less customers coming into your shop in town, 20 less families tithing in the church.
Right.
So they closed around their own and protected them so that the murderers got away with it. But the Donnellys still stayed pretty resolute. They were, again, a tough group. And it's a fascinating story that is not taught in Canadian history classes. Because, you know, Canadians, like a lot of British people, and of course, Canada was a British province for a long time, always look down our nose at Americans, you know, because you're wild and uncouth.
Right.
Well, it turns out we're just as bad as the Americans. You know? So it's we just didn't want to talk about it. You know? Right. So we had our Wild West period, too.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating, just like the American Wild West period. That's fascinating. You know? And so rather than try to pretend it didn't occur, I want to try and bring it up to the surface and say, yeah, this is what it was. Embrace it. This is where we come from. You know?
Yeah, so, yeah, I can't wait to read it. It sounds awesome. So it'll be out in the fall, right, John?
Yeah, it's supposed to be coming out in October.
Okay, all right.
Well, called The Donnellys.
All right, I'll keep all my listeners abreast of that so we can all support you.
Well, thank you, sir.
All right.
Great talking to you, John, as always. So
yeah, it's great talking to you, John.
Yeah, you be well, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay, thanks for all your stories about Mike Munster. I really appreciate it.
No problem.
All right, Mike. Take care of yourself.
You too, pal.
All right.
All right, thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends Podcast. Thank you to our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode of the show. And also thank you to all our Patreon donors who generously donate money to the podcast every month. And if you're interested in doing that, you can do that on our website, bodybuildinglegendshow.com. In the upper right-hand corner, you'll see the Patreon link. And don't forget about my audiobook for my book, Bodybuilding Heroes and Legends, Volume 1. If you like listening to audiobooks, you want to hear about my book in the car or on your phone, just purchase that audiobook and let me know what you think of it. All right. So before I let you guys go, I want to read this really great article written by Jack Neary about Mike Munster. And this was the article that John Little mentioned in our interview. It's called The Thinking Man's Bodybuilder. John said that Mike liked this article so much by Jack Neary that he actually put it in one of his books. He put it as a reprint in one of his books. All right, so it reads, "It was important, Mike Munster told me, that we find the green chartreuse and not the yellow. The urgency in his voice indicated the green kind commanded the more fearsome wallop of the two liqueurs. It's like sparklers going off in your head," he said, turning a bottle around to check the label. Seconds later, the great arm reached up to the highest shelf. The hand groped blindly past the first row of bottles and closed around one further back, as if it were a special treasure tucked away from view. Much as a child will stash the last of his favorite chocolate bars underneath bags of potato chips until he can return to his neighborhood confectionery with more money. Munster brought a bottle down, scowled at it for a moment, and then hefted it in his palm, checking his weight as a grocery shopper might with a grapefruit. "This is the stuff," he said, "the green." He pursed his lips and squinted violently. It was a gesture that suggested the considerable potency of the drink. Our fate had been secured. With sanguine disposition, we resigned ourselves to the prospect of some serious drinking. The bottle was opened en route to Munster's West Los Angeles apartment. The obligatory first sips were in order. Mine was a rather conservative one. Munster's warning of sparklers in the head had not gone unnoticed. I rolled the liquid around on my tongue for a few seconds before letting it slide lazily into the gut. A fiery sensation had worked itself up in my mouth, and truly, small explosions of pops of alcoholic fireworks created a flurry of activity in there. One felt compelled to borrow that from Gleason. Mmm, that good booze. Munster was receiving a vicarious thrill from all this. He reached for the bottle and took a healthy swig of the stuff. I could see him working the liqueur around furiously in his cheeks. A great deal of sloshing could be heard. Indeed, each drinking man has his own private ritual of enjoying his first taste of the evening. "Damn," he said. "What? Was he throwing a damper on the festivities so soon?" "I don't think we got the green kind. This is the yellow." He peered intently at the bottle, maneuvering its form so that a slice of passing streetlight illuminated the contents. "What color is this?" Munster thrust the bottle under my nose. "Looks yellow to me, but the hues are similar. It's an honest mistake. I never seem to get this right. I'm colorblind, you know. I have a difficult time picking one color from the next." "Oh, yes." Munster's apartment was not unfamiliar to me. Indeed, I had been its previous tenant. After I left my position as associate editor with Joe Weider's Muscle Builder magazine 5 months before, Munster had been hired. Like other Weider employees of the magazine before him, he moved into this particular apartment at the behest of Joe, whose wife's aunt owns the building. Even Joe and his wife Betty had lived in the unit a few years before. Mensah shared the apartment with his girlfriend, Kathy Gelfo, who was back home in Maryland for a visit. Without her influence, the place had gone to a shambles, but all in the interest of intellectual progress, one would assume, upon sight of the numerous volumes of Nietzsche, Miller, Whitman, and Sartre that scored a large round black table, which seemed to be the nerve center of the room. A good deal of the floor immediately in front of the fireplace was carpeted with forgotten editions of the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times Book Review. Erudition hung in all corners of the room. This suggested Mike Mensah is different from the average bodybuilder. But not that different, for it wasn't long after we had gotten into our cups that Mensah brought in a tall stack of well-thumbed and tattered muscle magazines from the bedroom and began leafing through them with enthusiasm. How many times has he done this before? And still, he examined each photograph with a newfound zeal. He commented on certain illustrations as if he were a neophyte. Shoo! A windy whisper of awe whistled from his lips. This is unbelievable. He held up for my inspection a photograph of Arnold Schwarzenegger hitting his patented front double bicep pose. I nodded approval. He took a long slug from his glass and then pulled up his sleeve and flexed his own left bicep. The nexus between the printed image of Arnold's mightily peaked upper arm and Mensah's own offering presented the evidence that there before me, smitten with a somewhat spirit-induced mood of euphoria, was a prospective successor to the Austrian Oaks' heralded title as the greatest bodybuilder in history. Never before had a top bodybuilder displayed such physical potential as Mensah. The muscle lengths and bellies, the insertions, tie-ins, and fullness of each muscle group conjured up thoughts of the all-natural resources one needs to create a Superman. Someday I'm going to surpass, said Mensah, indicating the monstrous proportions of Arnold. That remains to be seen, I responded, my tone redolent with doubt. Hey, I have no doubt in my mind that I will beat this. I have the greatest potential of any bodybuilder. I can see myself going past what Arnold ever developed. Mike, I know you're good, and I'm sure you're going to get better, but Arnold? I can't see anyone surpassing him for quite a while. Sure, Arnold had weaknesses, but when you put it all together, forget it. A fine edge of contention freighted Mensah's voice. Well, I'm not going to argue about it, but I know what I'm capable of, and I know what I'm going to do. Yes, there was no sense arguing about the future. Mensah is, after all, an existentialist, having been heavily influenced by the writings of Nietzsche and Sartre. His fate was in his own hands. He could control his own existence. We would wait and see. I remember the first impression Mensah made upon me. Of course, I did not know him when I first heard of him. He was on the East Coast in Maryland, and I was a mere bodybuilding fan in Canada. Mensah appeared on the cover of Muscle Builder magazine in the late spring of 1976. His countenance and massive torso graced the inaugural issue of the New Look Muscle Builder. The photograph showed Mensah in light blue posing trunks. He was in a rather relaxed posture with his fists turned knuckles in at his sides. A striking portrait, appearing at the time when Mensah had hardly cracked the social register of the sport. Who is this guy? I remember asking myself. There was a cocky tilt to his head and a look of confidence on his face. It made me uncomfortable, as I recall, to see a cover man of whom I knew nothing. The story inside proved even more disturbing, for it quoted Mensah saying in 1 year he would beat Arnold, my hero. The article was about Mensah's rather iconoclastic training system. So outrageous did his three sets per body part routine seem to me that I actually laughed out loud, and I took it all as a bad joke. I mean, one just couldn't build muscle doing 20-minute workouts only three times a week. How were we to take this bit of news when Arnold and Franco and half a dozen other Weider boys have been extolling the virtues of the double-split 20 sets per body part system on the pages of the very same journal for years? Not very seriously, I should think. My introduction to Mike Mensah via the columns of Muscle Builder did not rest easy in the brain pan. Not only did he challenge everything I thought to be correct about training, but he suggested the reigning king of the sport, Arnold Schwarzenegger, was no further away from him than a year's worth of this foolish training. Another cocky East Coast guy was my first impression. Not long ago, Arnold called me at my office in Weiderland. He was angered by some recent comments Mensah made about Arnold's methods of training. Tell Mike Mensah, Arnold's resonant Bavarian voice announced in notary tone, for me that he is an asshole. I read once again where he says that my training system is wrong. I'm pissed off. The whole idea is not to knock each other, but to help. If Mensur doesn't have anything good to say about someone else, he should keep his mouth shut. If I ever read or hear that he's knocking me again, I will see to it that nobody ever takes his training seriously. Tell him that. Had Arnold said that to me 2 years before, when I read that first Mensur training article, I would have struck up a hearty chorus of approval for the Austrian Oak. He was, after all, Arnold. And I'd rather look like him than Mensur. So naturally, I would have thought, I'm going to train as Arnold does. These days, I'm more inclined to say, if so many people train as Arnold does, then why aren't more people looking like Arnold? Because genetics predominates how any bodybuilder is going to look, said Mensur, who still held for my scrutiny the photograph of awesome Arnold in his other hand as he was sloshing the chartreuse and ice around in his glass. I asked him how he knew he could surpass Arnold. I have better genetic potential than Arnold. That's obvious. And I can reach my potential because I know what kind of training I have to do to get there. About 99% of the other bodybuilders haven't a clue about what's right for them and what's wrong. The first time I met Mensur in the flesh, my impressions of him being a cocky East Coast guy disappeared. It was minutes after his astounding victory at the IFBB AFAB 1976 Mr. America contest in New York City. Going to the contest as a reporter for Muscle Builder, I was not aware Mensur would be competing, so I hardly considered him to be among the contenders. A few weeks before the contest, his name was mentioned in a conversation with Roger Callard at Gold's Gym. I'm not even worried about him, said Callard, who with Danny Padilla, I had already considered the man to beat. I've already beaten Mensur twice before. He shouldn't be hard to beat again. Padilla held Mensur in higher esteem and had mentioned in his own quiet way that Mensur would be the biggest challenge. But even with this knowledge, I did not give Mensur much thought before the competition. In the dressing room, only a half hour before the crucial prejudging at the Felt Forum, where several of the bodybuilders were milling about, I had little idea that the huge man sitting mere yards from me was Mensur. I was absorbed by a conversation Callard was having about his own calves. Roger had pulled up a leg of his sweatpants to reveal a tumulus of flesh clinging to his shin. He remarked sarcastically that for some reason his calves wouldn't grow. Mensur, who had also been listening in, said, "That isn't a calf, that's a cow," which was an apt metaphor for when calves grow, they do become cows. It was only after a contest official had taken Mensur's incredible statistics for the record and had said, "Thanks, Mike," that I realized here was Mensur. As the competitors filed out for the prejudging, Mensur created quite a sensation as he took his spot before the judging panel. Audible gasps came from the people's mouths as they first saw Mensur. He was in tremendous condition. He had excelled far beyond the condition we saw him on the cover of the magazine. What struck me particularly about Mensur's physique was the size of his triceps, and upon them, the lateral striations which showed through paper-thin skin. I had never seen such detail in anyone's rear upper arm. One fellow standing next to me exhorted, "Look at those calves, the best calves in the world." My gaze focused on his lower legs. They were startling in their size, and their peculiar knotty formation of them seemed bizarre. But in my opinion, they are not the best calves in the world. "No way," I said. "Ken Waller's calves are better. Better shape, fuller throughout the length of the muscles." The chap did not argue. I might have received an argument from another person seated not far away, but perhaps her unfamiliarity with me kept Mike's girlfriend, Kathy, from sounding off. Mensur hasn't a stauncher supporter than Kathy, who, in spite of her unlimited admiration, may be his own worst enemy. When it comes to her, Michael, she is the least objective person I know. He is unbeatable in her eyes. Kathy is a barometer to Mensur's moods. If he's down, she may sink even lower. She becomes angry when someone doesn't applaud Mensur's performance at an exhibition or contest. I've never heard Kathy criticize the man about bodybuilding, which is testimony to unwavering loyalty. "She's the best thing that's ever happened to me," said Mensur. "I've never heard a word of discouragement from her. If I broke up with her today, I'd never find someone to replace her. Never." I suggested that Mensur's calves were not the greatest this end of the universe left me open to a good deal of psychic malcontent and bombardment from Kathy. "I actually hated you for a whole year after what you said about Michael's calves," she told me later. "Every time your name came up, I really burned. I felt you had an attitude against Michael. I have learned to limit my criticism of Mensur to moments when she is beyond hearing range. One can only withstand so much ill will." After Mensur's triumph in New York, I introduced myself to him. Needing quotes for my contest report, I asked him the standard questions one asks an athlete moments following a win. Then I caught him slightly off guard with a more aggressive query. Do you still think you can beat Arnold in a year? Well, I might have been a little hasty in saying that. But a year later, over drinks at his apartment, he said it again. And once more, I was doubtful. Menzer put away the picture of Arnold. He rifled through the stack of magazines. Then he pulled out the issue of his first cover. Now, that's the best cover I've ever seen, he said, mockingly arrogant. I thought differently, I said. When I first saw that, I thought you were a cocky East Coast guy who thought he could beat everybody. Oh, I still do, he said, feigning seriousness. After your victory at the 1976 America, you told me that cover helped you improve 95%. I don't know where you got that exact number, but I'll take your word for it. Yeah, when Joe Weider put me on the cover, I was so surprised. It was the greatest inspiration I could receive. It really fired me up. What about the second cover after your America victory? Well, that was great too, yeah, but nothing tops the first cover. What a thrill. I remember rushing into the drugstore after I heard I was on it. I bought up a pile of copies. I had a very favorable reaction back home. Of course, it's better than ever now. All the things that Joe has done to help me, all the constant publicity, is good. It keeps your name up there where people can see it. I like to think I've helped Joe, but, you know, he didn't have to do all this that he did for me. Since he was 12, Menzer has known that he wanted to be Mr. America. He first became interested in bodybuilding after he saw an Italian muscle movie featuring Steve Reeves. For a year, he badgered his dad for a set of weights. The next Christmas, he received a barbell and plates. Menzer trained in his basement at his home in Euphrata, Pennsylvania for 2 years. Occasionally, his dad took him to the muscle epics of New York City, where he saw the greats, Scott, Poole, Wayne, Oliva, Arnold, and Franco. During this time, his dad, Harry, a truck driver, introduced Menzer to some friends who were training seriously at a fellow's garage gym. That's what hooked Menzer. Bill Pearl was his hero. For a period of 3 years, he wrote Pearl once a week, heaping praise and adulation on the four-time Mr. Universe winner. When Pearl replied, Menzer would wax euphoric for days. Even now, Menzer speaks of Pearl in almost religious tones. Bill Pearl was so much to me, he said. I like his ruggedness. I still say he's a man's man. He makes other bodybuilders look like women. He's a no-nonsense guy. In Acapulco, where I won my Mr. Universe title, he was there to present me the trophy, and that was a thrill. He's almost 50, and he looks almost as good as anyone. In grade 10, as Menzer shunned other sports in favor of weight training, Harry's encouragement turned to disparagement. My dad was a football nut, and he just couldn't understand why I'd want to lift weights all the time when the other sports seemed to offer so much more. Same with all the guys at school. They couldn't see why I wanted to waste my time when I could be going for the glory accepted team sports provided. Well, I kept at it because I loved it, and I've always imagined myself going far in the sport. At 17, Menzer weighed an enormous 250 pounds. He was able to squat with 600 pounds. I put on so much weight so fast, that's why I've got all these stretch marks on my skin. I went on a Joe Weider craze. I was taking tons of that crash weight gain number 7. Still a teenager, Menzer joined the Air Force in 1970. He survived the full 4 years. He doesn't regret joining. Just after I graduated from high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I'd always entertained the idea of going into medicine. I still have that goal. But then I didn't think I was quite ready for it. I really lacked direction. I saw the military as a way of giving me something to get me on track. Yet Menzer is no small distance from a hawk's thinking. He runs more along the line of John Lennon than Lieutenant William Calley. The military life as lived by Menzer seemed paradoxical. I didn't want the military to impinge upon my personal life, and it didn't. The first couple of weeks in boot camp were tough, but after that I enjoyed it. You see, in the first 2 weeks, they really work you to see what you're made of. If they see you can handle it, the discipline and all, they start to ease up and even provide encouragement. And they really respect the guy who's well built. My first month, I was made squad leader just because I was big and muscular. Menzer won his first contest, Mr. Lancaster County, in 1971. That year, he also won the Mr. Pennsylvania, and he placed 10th in the AAU Mr. America. A month after the America, he hurt his shoulder badly doing dumbbell flies. In spite of it, he managed to place 2nd in the Teenage Mr. America, and he won all the body part awards. Despite Menzer's poor showing at his first America, it may have been the single most important day of his bodybuilding career. There he met the winner, Casey Viator, who was being heralded as a child phenomenon. Both men were 19. From Viator, Menzer learned the basis of the heavy-duty training system. Casey really got me interested in his training that day, said Mentzer. He was doing 30-minute workouts three times a week, only about four sets per body part. And, well, he looked unbelievable. Very strong, very thick. Even Arnold came to that contest to check him out. Casey was training under the supervision of Arthur Jones in Florida. Arthur invented the Nautilus machines and most of the principles associated with the equipment. At the time, I was dejected because I wasn't improving. I was training 3 hours a day, 6 days a week. I was following the conventional methods hailed by the champs of the day, and I simply put, I was overtraining. Up to that, I wouldn't dream of questioning these training methods. Who was I next to Arnold or Franco? Casey's training came as a breath of fresh air. It sparked a new interest for me at a time when I was going to quit. For 3 years, Mentzer steered clear of the gym, allowing his injured shoulder time to heal. But his enthusiasm was high. He kept in touch with Arthur Jones. In 1974, Mentzer went to DeLand, Florida, and he observed Jones's operation. I was really impressed. Arthur is a hard man to get to know, and many people have run into trouble with him. But if he knows you're genuinely sincere about learning, he will treat you like a king. We got along well. I can go on for days about Arthur. He's the only genius I've known. I stayed there for 3 months, but I had to leave because I couldn't find work. So I went to college, University of Maryland, studied liberal arts, and I began the trek toward med school. What Mentzer has done with Jones's principles is no small accomplishment. Until Mentzer arrived on the bodybuilding scene, the Nautilus theories were underpublicized, if not clandestine, and were used chiefly by football teams. Bodybuilders, said Mentzer, were living in the dark ages when it came to training research. Spewing wisdom and well-researched advice at seminars and in his training courses, Mentzer is now providing the necessary enlightenment. While it's true many top bodybuilders train 6 days a week for up to several hours a day, it does not necessarily follow that such training methods were directly responsible for their development. These men are genetic freaks who would grow on any system. Had they trained for shorter periods with high-intensity methods, many of these top bodybuilders could have developed further or might have reached their current levels much sooner. Yes, but how does Mike Mentzer know other top bodybuilders don't train with the intensity he does? Well, it's obvious. They all do at least 20 sets per body part. If they were going to go all out in each set, right from the first set, they wouldn't be able to do more than six. They're pacing themselves so that they can do 20 sets. I have an analogy. A long-distance runner runs more than a sprinter, yet the runner has skinny legs, whereas the sprinter has thick, muscular legs. That's because when the sprinter does run, it's all out. You can sprint 200 yards, but you can't sprint a mile. You have to pace for a mile, and it's true the same with other bodybuilders' workouts. Yet for all the logic of Mentzer's theories, most bodybuilders meet the ideas with resistance, refusing to part with conventional methods. But enough curious people are buying his courses and attending his seminars to put Mentzer on the road to his first $1 million. This fall, his book will be published by William Morrow of New York. For a long time, I was on the verge of starving. I was living in an apartment overrun with cockroaches. I slept on a thin mattress on the floor. Books were strewn in the width and breadth of my place. Then I win the America, receive some publicity, come out with courses, do seminars and exhibitions, travel all around the world. Everything has changed so quickly. Once I was beating my brains out trying to make it. Now I'm desperate for a moment alone with Kathy. The pace is killing, but I enjoy it. For all his distractions, Mentzer isn't forgetting his main purpose to win the Olympia. After competing in 3 pro contests in as many months, winning one in Miami, he's learned an awful lot about pacing oneself for competition. I'm not going to go in any more contests this year except the Olympia. I'm devoting 9 weeks to it. That's longer than I've ever trained for a contest. Too many other shows can drain you. And that's the end. All right. Thanks to Jack Neary for that great article by Mike Mentzer. And like I said, guys, I will have a lot more articles coming up for you in the next few months because I got this big stack of muscle builders last week. So look forward to that. All right. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Join us next week when our guest will be the great 8-time Mr. Olympia, Lee Haney, and he will be joined by one of his boyhood idols, the great pro bodybuilder, Roy Callender. So that'll be next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Until then, stay healthy, enjoy your workouts, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.